You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 90 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. And we have a special guest with us today.
Hello.
It is the famous Cousin Katie. Joining us is the third Pelton brother for the first matchup in the Peltoncast search for Seattle's best dumplings. What a show.
So excited.
Oh, I can't wait. The famous and available Cousin Katie. There are very few people who live a block away from me and are available late at night when we record this podcast.
It is very convenient.
In the Daryl Bevel firing hour, as I like to call it.
Well, she was the one who alerted us last week to Daryl Bevel's firing. So you are going to start us off today by cracking open our beer.
This is a beer that I haven't had. This is the Rogue Dead Guy Ale, like the signature Rogue beer. I haven't had this for years.
Shouts to one of our other cousins, Chris. Loyal listener Chris, for getting this as part of our Christmas Eve gift exchange, and that's why I picked it up there, and now all of us will be enjoying it together on the podcast.
Shout down to Chris, though, for something we were talking about a second ago.
Really bringing the family drama on this pod.
For at that same Christmas gift exchange, I actually tweeted about this when it happened, getting milk bar cake balls and not sharing them. I mean, come on! We were all here salivating at these milk balls. You'd brought them back from, where did you bring them from? New York City?
I did not bring them. I ordered them. I had previously gotten them in New York City and not shared them myself.
Wait, what? How did what? You order them from afar?
Yeah, I ordered them online.
Wait, you could do that?
Yeah.
Oh.
It was even free shipping when I did it.
You should be, what? It's free. Why are we not doing this all the time?
I don't know.
You made it seem like you brought them with you from your New York in the suitcase. Like you.
All right, I take back my shout down, Chris.
Why?
Because, I mean, if we can just order them.
Yeah, it's not quite as special as it seemed, as it turns out. I mean, still, I'm not sure they're, you know. Yeah, I mean, we don't know what the freshness was like on those ones.
You could tell us, though, Chris. Just let us know. If you can just order them and it's free shipping, imagine that as a gift idea for a special occasion for someone.
That's why I brought it for our gift exchange. I thought it was a great idea.
Oh, my God.
So now that we've poured this Rogue Dead Guy ale, I wanted to propose a toast to our grandfather who passed away last Friday night at the age of 95. A long, full life that resulted in, you know, without him, there would be no Peltoncast, it is safe to say.
That's true, scientifically speaking.
Yes.
I was wondering if you had any good grandpa sports moments.
I don't know if I do have any good grandpa sports moments. Do you have one in mind?
There are a couple that I thought of.
I think I have one.
Okay. Go for it.
Oh, sorry. We were. I lived next door to grandpa when I was in my last year of law school. So he would have been, I don't know. God, that's so long ago. Maybe
it was about 80? It was 85? About a decade ago.
Okay, yeah. 85, and he helped me put up a basketball hoop, down there below the house. And I remember him coming out at 85 to try to play basketball with us. And him actually being able to dribble and make a shot at 85. And I thought that was pretty terrific.
Yeah, if we're moving that well at 85, amazing outcome.
That hoop is also much taller than 10 feet.
That is accurate.
Well, you know, very impressive.
We didn't really know what we were doing.
The moments that I thought of was, number one, this isn't a specific moment, but always being willing to, before a Mariners game, go and park a car in the morning by the Kingdom or Safeco Field.
That's very
because
accurate.
Our family was too cheap to pay for parking near the stadium, or too unwilling to walk, like really a short distance. That we've learned, he was always willing to go in the morning and drop off a car.
The idea of paying to park at a sporting event still something that I consider completely untenable.
That's one of those dominant traits. Pass straight down.
I feel like that's really originated with our mom more than with grandpa.
You think he's paying for parking? No way.
That's a good point.
A good point. Look, if he was paying for parking, he would have just been like, I'll give you this money. I'm not driving down to the stadium in the morning.
That's a fair point.
I always wonder if other people do that. The other thing was, I know you consider this a sport at least, but the history of hydroplane fandom.
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, our family so into hydroplane racing, and it starts with our grandparents who started going to the original Seafair when they first had it. I think that was, what, 1950, the first Seafair hydroplane race?
They went to Seafair number one.
They did. And there are stories about our mom, who was born not long after that, attending hydroplane races in like a crib, basically.
They
rolled it out there?
I don't know exactly what the logistics were. I didn't check into that, but that's the story.
They endured the horrible experience that was going to hydroplane races for 70 years.
It may not have been as horrible for all 70 of those years.
Much more lawless back in the day.
Yeah.
I couldn't remember any other great sports moments, though.
Yeah, I mean, our grandfather was a sports fan, but I don't know if he was like he wasn't a huge sports fan. It's not necessarily where our sports fandom came from.
Well, I think, like a lot of people around this time period, really started engaging with the Seahawks this last decade in the kind of Pete Carroll, Russell Wilson era. But I had this thought. Our mom was talking. This is not a good thought. You might just want to take this out. But I had this thought. Our mom was on the phone like last days, and she was talking to a person at this like home facility that he was living at. She was like, "Can you just put on some random football game? He'll be engaged in that." And we're driving by the VMAC Center, and I was like, "Why are we even paying attention to sports? Like, what does this matter at all? Come on."
I don't understand how you got from that one place to the other.
I don't know. I just had this thought. I was like, we're all going to die someday. Why do we care about sports?
Wow. On that note, welcome to the podcast.
But then...
Turn it off and consider your own mortality.
This last Sunday, I felt like I was really reinvigorated when it came to sport.
Because of the Vikings-Saints game?
Just that whole day of sports. All of a sudden, I was like, oh, this is why we care. Look at this raw emotion that's happening. I watched that play, the Stephon Diggs touchdown, after it was posted online, after from every different angle, over and over again, listening to the roar of the crowd, and thinking back to the Jaguars winning a playoff game in Pittsburgh. And I was like, oh, sports are fun. That's why we pay attention to sports, because it's a fun thing to do.
Sports are fun when you win, as it turns out. Not as fun when you lose. We will talk a little bit more about the reason we didn't catch the Vikings Saints ending live in a second. But first, you have probably seen online the sensation sweeping Twitter lately. It's been on numerous ESPN shows, started by my friend and former colleague Tom Haberstroh, the ALS Pepper Challenge, which he and his family decided to do in honor of Mama Haberstroh, who was diagnosed with ALS. And I have been challenged to the ALS Pepper Challenge, which, true to its name, requires you to eat a hot pepper. So I'm going to do this live on the podcast. We are also taping it, so you can check
so
out
excited.
The video
wow.
on the Peltoncast webpage. Wait, should we talk a second first before we start this? About how crazy it is that
recording this for the podcast.
Yeah, crazy it is that I am eating a hot pepper. You have tweeted about this.
So you haven't in your entire life. Have you ever eaten a jalapeno?
Like, no.
A bell pepper?
Not really.
A green pepper?
I mean, I've eaten slices of green peppers at Subway. Or on pizza. That's probably as close as we've gotten to eating a pepper.
I got Windy City Pie this last weekend, and you were furious at me for having jalapenos on it.
That is inaccurate.
And look what you're about to embark upon. What do you think is the hottest food you've ever had in your entire life?
I mean, I've eaten hot food. I mean...
Temperature-wise. But spice-wise.
I mean, like... various cow soy or the spicy Korean chicken that we had a few weeks ago, that was probably up there. It's just like never the actual pepper itself. That's a new experience for me.
Oh my God.
And now we're going to videotape it.
Okay.
Okay. I've now completed the ALS pepper challenge, and I don't know how effective I'm going to be podcasting because I need to constantly be drinking ginger ale
now. Not as bad as it could have been.
Could have been a lot worse.
I'm really disappointed.
I don't know. I thought it was pretty funny when he started hiccuping. I thought that was pretty good. Yeah, I thought that was good.
Uncontrollable.
I just wanted you to catch on fire or something. I eat way more spicy foods than you. And I had one of these peppers last week just casually. I was like, I'm just going to eat this pepper. It's not going to affect me at all. It'll basically be the same as a jalapeno. I'll just like take a sip of beer and it'll be gone. And then I was eating it. I was like, oh shit, this is hot. This is a very different experience than I was anticipating. And now I've been challenged to do it again.
There you go.
Is your mouth still on fire?
A little bit.
A little bit.
You're sweating. Unbearable. You're definitely, you sweat a lot, but you're definitely still sweating.
Both of those things are true. The frequency with which I need to take a drink of the ginger ale is decreasing.
Really? Man, this is not bad.
Not bad at all. Wow. All right. Do we want to turn our attention from peppers to dumplings?
I'm just a little bit disappointed it wasn't more extreme.
I can sense the disappointment.
Because so, I've said it over and over and over
again. As I mentioned earlier, the reason you didn't see the Saints-Vikings game live is because you and the famous cousin Katie, along with your significant others, were at Dozone last Sunday night trying out one of our eight contenders in the bracket as we search for Seattle's best dumplings. And this weekend, Dozone is the number two seed in the soup dumpling region, went up against a late entrant. One that we did not know about until Zach Whitman, Third Pelton brother and dumpling enthusiast, brought it to our attention on Twitter last week, and we immediately added to the competition is the number three seed in the soup dumpling bracket region, Mama's Dough in Kent, located in the Great Wall Mall, which is the first time I'd ever been there, and I'm definitely going back, is my takeaway. So we have eaten these two dumplings, and now we are going to pick the winner. Let's start. As often with our guest, Katie, what was your choice?
Can we go through with what everybody had first? Just like a summary of the foods that were eaten at each place, and then we vote?
Okay.
So what did you have? I got Mama's Dough to go. So I might not have given it it might not have been presented in its best possible light.
Yeah. Both of us had it in the restaurant, and then I also brought Katie some to go when I went there today. So I had the pork soup dumplings, as well as the lamb fried dumplings, which are kind. It seems like the fried dumplings, even though they have the soup dumplings, are in the soup dumpling region, are kind of their specialty as the pan fried dumplings. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, they were different, not like anything I'd ever had before, and they're really good.
Yeah, because they're basically fried upside down, so that you get like a layer of. It's almost kind of like an unsweet pancake.
Yeah.
In terms of the fry on the bottom, connecting the dumplings. It's really unlike anything else I've ever had before.
Ah, I didn't get that. I'm so upset about not getting it. See, I had the shrimp soup dumplings, the pork soup dumplings.
Crab soup dumplings.
Or sorry, the crab and the pork soup dumplings. And then I had the lamb steamed dumplings, but not the lamb pan-fried dumplings. And I feel like this was a huge mistake.
It was.
Yeah.
This is one of the things about the dumpling bracket is you probably need to go to these places multiple times to really figure it out and try a wide variety. Fortunately, I think between us, we got a pretty good variety at Mama's Dough. How about at Dozone?
At Dozone, we went with quite a few because there were more of us there. We had the pork soup dumplings, the crab soup dumplings, I believe a steamed chicken and a steamed vegetable. And then there was something else on the table. I don't even know.
The kubao, which I don't know if you count as a dumpling.
The kubao, which we're going to talk about in a second.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think they technically qualify in the dumpling bracket.
Which is like a pork bun.
So I actually had Dozone twice in the past week. I went there for lunch last week in the International District and then had you guys bring me to Dozone from the Issaquah location when you went there on Sunday night. And between those, I had both the types of soup dumplings, both pork and crab. Then I also had, I think I had chicken boiled dumplings.
Okay.
And then I had fried dumplings that were chive one of the times and maybe something else that I'm forgetting. But look, I don't know if we want to jump ahead here. The real star at Dozone, this is true everywhere, but particularly at Dozone, the star is the soup dumplings.
I disagree with you.
Real? Oh, because of the fact that, okay, of the dumplings, the star is the soup dumpling.
The soup dumpling is the star of dumplings.
Yeah.
See, I didn't feel that way necessarily about Mama's Dough because of the fact that these pan-fried dumplings are so good.
We should stop recording. Are they open right now?
I'm pretty sure they are
not. God. Okay, they were better than the soup dumplings at the Mama's Dough.
Yeah, I mean, the Mama's Dough, it's operating on such a smaller scale. Like, if you go to Dozone or Din Tai Fung, it's an industrial scale. You've got a dozen people in that small room there handcrafting the dumplings. At Mama's Dough, there was at times one person doing this.
Yes.
And they were, so the dough is a little more uneven and maybe a little doughier, I would say. And then the soup wasn't quite as flavorful. I mean, that's the thing about the Dozon soup dumplings. When you bite in and you get that burst of soup right into your mouth, it is the most flavorful food experience you could possibly have.
And wow. I thought the unevenness of the dough consistency was just because I got it like to go, or I had it very late in the meal. But if you're saying you had that, you know, even at the beginning, that makes me think it might just be a problem with their soup dumplings.
Which is not
all
to
the
say
time.
Bad.
No,
it's
no,
just
no,
that
no.
They're not as good as Dozon, which may or may not have the best dumplings in Seattle. We'll find out.
I felt like the soup dumplings also having them to go, they felt a little bit dried out.
Yeah.
See, I'm sure that exacerbated it, but they were a little more dried out.
You could kind of tell they were a little bit harder on top than they should have been.
Yeah, and again, these are like Mama's Dough for what they're doing, for being a close to a hole in the wall, essentially a restaurant, as opposed to these places where you have to wait in line for a half hour to get in. It's a very different experience. Like, you have to know that going in. All right, do you want to talk about the Q-Bow?
Well, let's go. Katie, do you want to start with your vote for the winner of the 2-3 seed in the soup dumpling region for the best dumpling in Seattle?
I had to go with, are we doing this on a 1 to 100 scale?
No,
we're
just,
not
just
right now. You're just picking
oh,
a winner.
Oh, just, okay. Well, I chose the Dozon.
What were your 100 ratings in it, since it appears you have compiled those?
Very arbitrary. It was 95 to 94.
Wow.
Oh, that was
very
close.
Very close.
Yeah, really close to me. But I kind of took Tristan's factoring in all aspects of the experience that he did when he talked about Loretta's actually being the best burger in Seattle, where he talked about like the ambiance and all that. So I kind of took that into account. And there are some other things on the menu in each of those places that are perhaps better than the dumplings that kind of affected my votes there and made the ratings overall really high.
What was better at the Mama's Dough?
I think the spicy pork brisket soup with the hand-shaven noodles was the best thing that I had there.
I got that too, and I thought that was pretty good. I don't know. I just really like dumplings.
I really like the hand-shaven noodles. I thought
hand-shaven noodles are great
so
also.
Good.
God, it's all good.
I mean, that's the thing. I think it's a fair point whether we're searching for Seattle's best dumplings, but if we're searching for just Seattle's best dumpling restaurant, that is a slightly different question. Has anyone raved about the Q-Bow yet?
Dozon is the winner either way.
I agree.
Dozon's dumplings are near perfect. To me, going in, they're the favorite of the dumpling bracket. They might be the 2 seed, but they're like the NCAA tournament team that lost one too many games, but on KenPom is still number one.
Are they? I mean, I was struggling to come up with a good like sports comparison for Din Tai Fung versus Dozon.
I just gave it to you.
No, but
Din Tai Fung is like Duke. Din Tai Fung will be on the number one seed all the time, but Dozon is like Michigan State, and you know who's going to win here. We know what's going to happen. I'll be curious to see them head-to-head, but Dozon is so good at every single thing they do. Their dumplings are near perfect, right? The consistency is excellent. The soup explodes with flavor in the soup dumplings, but the real star of the meal is the Q-Bow. These are pork buns with soup inside of them, and the pork bun experience is great on its own, but this elevates it to such a different level. We are talking, this was top 5 foods I've ever eaten with these.
Wow.
With this Q-Bow. Top five foods ever.
That's a Tristan wow.
It's really good.
I'm curious.
Katie's not disputing this at all. You had one. So we were there. There was one left.
I've had them before.
There was one left on the table, and I wanted it desperately.
We all did.
Why didn't we just order more?
I don't know. Everybody was being very weird about it.
God.
I mean, that would have been more time for me babysitting all 4 of your children.
No, they come fast.
I'm really enjoying this dumpling bracket so far just because of that.
Yes. I was telling Mrs. Fantasy Genius that this is the most amazing sneak to get you to watch our children when we go out to eat.
I mean, it only worked here because I had previously gone 2 does out.
We'll see. But we should have gotten another order of them at the end, and we'd already gotten 2 orders. We actually only ordered 1, but 2 appeared because of the dumpling gods.
Oh, see, I had the opposite experience at Mama's Dough. I tried to order both the pork and the crab soup dumplings and only got the pork. Although in hindsight, after having seen, like, I was there by myself, and so the downside of the pan-fried dumplings is they come in a 12-pack. And that's a lot of dumplings.
That is no downside.
So many dumplings.
It's a lot for one person. 12 pan fried dumplings is a lot.
You could eat it easily. That's the best thing about this dumpling bracket is that dumplings are great.
Puffy, exactly.
But if we get a chance to eat that cubao again soon, I'm going to be very excited. Here's the thought that I have. We should go Din Tai Fung and Dozon right after each other.
In this part of the semifinals?
It's the only way we can know. If Din Tai Fung wins the 1-4 round, it's the only way we can know which is actually better.
Yeah, I like its odds. It's going up against the 16 seed in this metaphor.
But that cubao, it's like a soup dumpling where the soup is so flavorful, the pork is perfect inside of it. But the dough, you have the dough and you're just like...
And then the fried the part fry, at the bottom makes it.
The fried on the bottom.
On top.
It's great. My God.
I don't know when this became a search for Seattle's best pan fried bao. Yeah.
It's almost like a soup dumpling, though. It's
a giant soup dumpling?
So yeah. Close. Because the dough is even better than a soup dumpling.
All right. Well,
you haven't given your vote officially.
Well, my vote was also for Dozon. I would say it was more like a 97-93 margin for me. It was a little more solid. I mean, I think that Mama's Dough is a very strong number 3 seed, but Dozon is also a really strong number 2 seed. So that's what made it difficult here. So again, next week...
Wait, I have more to say about dumplings. The best thing about this is we did the search for Seattle's best burger last summer, right? There are kind of bad burgers out there. We had a lot of burgers, even sometimes the best burgers. You look at them and you're just like, I do not want to eat this burger right now.
I disagree with this take entirely.
I have never felt that way about dumplings. Every single soup dumpling is better than every single burger.
Wow. Oh, man.
Oh, my God.
I don't know about that.
I mean, do some soup dumplings go as well when you've been drinking?
I think they do.
I don't know. The 1 a.m. soup dumpling just doesn't sound quite the same as the 1 a.m.
Dicks. The cubao would be really good.
That's a fair point.
I mean, come on.
Good in every situation. The best, when I got the dumplings to go from Mama's Dough, I stopped into the market at the Great Wall Mall, got a 6-pack of Tsingtao, and I was able to drink while eating the dumplings. It was amazing.
Well, there you go.
Anyway, we're the real winners because we get to eat a lot of dumplings.
I mean, yeah, that's what we're learning here is why do we eat dumplings constantly?
It also is, I think, much more expensive than search for Seattle's best burger.
Yeah, I mean, my lunch for just me was like $30.
Especially because I want to eat all the dumplings.
All right. Anyways, stay tuned next week when we pick a new third Belton brother to help us decide between Din Tai Fung and the number 4 seed, Dim Sum Factory in Factoria.
Is this
an appropriate place for Dim Sum Factory to be?
Should we ask Zach to do it?
No, we're going to save Zach for the semifinals.
Okay.
Wow. He needs to be here for the most important call.
Wow. Okay.
But we didn't ask Katie her dumpling credentials. That's a huge, huge mistake, which it turns out are basically exactly the same as our dumpling credentials.
Wait.
Her finger is up.
Wait. Oh, you should tell your dumpling credentials first.
Just eating dumplings.
Not even that many. No. Like dumplings.
I don't have to consider. Our dumpling credentials are going to be a lot stronger after we've completed the dumpling bracket. I mean, I have eaten dumplings 3 times now in the past week. So.
It's more about future dumpling credentials.
This has Katie.
Okay, so, you know, I've eaten dumplings, but like in the burger contest, I try to go for the, you know, best and also craziest credential to you know, show that I'm really qualified. My one claim to dumpling fame is that I had a transcendental experience eating dumplings at a Dozon in Bellevue.
What?
Can I?
Yeah, go.
Okay.
Channel your inner David Lynch.
It was my family and a bunch of other families with kids and older people in there eating, and they were playing a very serene selection of Chinese woodwind and harp type music.
Huh.
And after they delivered the dumplings to the table, for some reason, the song Gucci Gang by Lil Pump came blaring over the speakers. And everyone, including the older folks and the families with kids, was just like cool with it, and they went right along eating. And let me tell you, eating dumplings while Lil Pump makes fun of your mom for living in a tent is quite something. I think I was transported to a higher plane of existence when Gucci Gang came on just as I was biting into a soup dumpling. Anyway, now when I eat dumplings, I can't help but rap to myself, Gucci gang, Gucci gang, Gucci gang, Gucci gang, spend 10 racks on dumplings, my bit, love to eat them, thanks, Gucci gang, Gucci gang, Gucci gang, Gucci gang. So to answer your question, I would say I'm pretty qualified to talk about which dumplings are best.
Wow, the bar has been set for dumpling credentials.
I think our
credentials are nowhere near that.
I think our podcast just had a transcendent moment. That's what, the only way that could have been better, by the way, is if it was the song Tucci Gang.
Did you watch that sketch? It was like they had the idea. They were like, hey, Gucci kind of sounds like Tucci. And that was it.
But it was a great idea.
Really funny. And then it just, I don't know what's happening.
He says Tucci Gang and you're like, oh, that's funny. But then it stops being funny every single time after that.
I enjoyed it. Comes back. Stops being funny and then comes back.
It doesn't happen enough.
All right.
Ugh.
Should we move on to sports?
Man, if we have to. I'm ready to talk about dumplings a lot longer.
You clearly are. We have a lot of roundup this week. Just kind of, these Seattle sports are largely in off-season mode, and things are happening of some of more importance and some of less importance. We'll start with the Seattle Sounders, who signed University of Washington midfielder Handwala Buana as a homegrown player last week. Buana played 2 years at UW, was the Pac-12 Freshman of the Year as a freshman, and then as a sophomore had 8 goals and 6 assists last season, and now will join the Sounders. Probably not likely to play a lot right away, but someone for them to have in the developmental pipeline.
S2 is where he's going to play?
Yeah, it would be unsurprising if he got some experience there. Buana, also a Kenyan refugee who came to the U.S. in 2010. Also in Sounders news, they have hired MLS legend Preki to join their coaching staff. Preki started his U.S. career with the Tacoma Stars, who played indoor soccer in the MISL, where he played with Brian Schmetzer. They later teamed with the St. Louis Storm in the same league. Preki joined MLS when it started in 1996 and was a two-time league MVP. He's managed both Chivas USA and to its best success, and then later Toronto FC. Most recently was a manager in USL with St. Louis FC, so adds a lot of experience to the Sounders.
You know it's an MLS legend when I've never heard of them.
It was the early days. I mean, this is like 1990 that he was played for the Tacoma Stars. You were like 5, so it's been a while. Let's see. Also, staying in the soccer realm, the Seattle Reign acquired USWNT midfielder Allie Long from Portland in a 3-team trade. She helped lead the Thorns to 2 championships and was part of the NWSL Best 11 in both 2015 and 2016, but fell out of favor toward the end of last season as they kind of changed their style of play. She's age 30 and has 33 caps for the USWNT, so a nice addition there for the Seattle Reign. Also in the women's sports front, the Seattle Storm beginning WNBA free agency. The negotiating period started on Monday, and then players can be signed starting on February 1st. The Storm, for the third consecutive year, decided to core Crystal Langhorne, their starting center. That guarantees her a one-year deal at the maximum salary of $113,000, kind of similar to the franchise tag, except the value of the contract does not escalate when you're cored in repeated years.
And you make like $30 million less dollars.
There's also that. Other Storm players in free agency, Sammy Whitcomb, the UW star who came off the bench for them last year as an undrafted rookie. She's a reserved player, meaning she can negotiate only with the Storm. And then veterans Noelle Quinn and Carolyn Swords are unrestricted free agents. Swords, a bit of a disappointment last season in Seattle, so I wouldn't expect her back. Some possible replacements as far as unrestricted free agent centers they could look at to try to fill that void, which has been a big need for the team. Jessica Breland, Sandrine Gruda, Courtney Paris, the former Oklahoma star, and then Kia Vaughn. So some names to watch in February. We'll keep an eye on WNBA free agency.
Okay.
UW men's basketball. A split last weekend as they opened the home portion of their Pac-12 schedule. A 66-56 win on Thursday against California, followed by a 73-64 loss Saturday to Stanford. And this one kind of felt like a bringing the Huskies down to earth game. Because we knew that they were like, you know, how people thought the Huskies were playing was not nearly
as
good.
You bring the Huskies down to earth for us every single day.
So much.
I want people's expectations to be realistic so they're not disappointed.
We didn't have to be realistic last year when I was tweeting about how they were terrible. We were like, too soon for that.
It's fundamentally optimistic to have low expectations. I strongly believe it. Because you're not like disappointed and upset when teams inevitably fall short of your unrealistic expectations.
How is that optimistic though?
Because the pessimism comes when your optimism is dashed. And so that's why I feel that the pessimism is ultimately more optimistic. It's convoluted.
I'm confused.
We're on another plane of existence.
It's logic.
Gucci A, Gucci A, Gucci A. this. So last weekend, all things considered, was not very good for UW. Cal, at this point, after getting blown out at Wazoo for their first conference win, is now the worst major conference team in college basketball.
Wow.
Yeah, Cal's bad.
Yeah. So the Huskies beating them by 10, really not that impressive, all things considered.
And having one of their better players foul out pretty early in that
Marcus
one.
Lee missed a lot of time in that game. So, oh, and in addition to their guard, yeah.
Lemon or something? Don Lemon? That's no, probably that's not his name, but I'm pretty sure it is.
Yeah, let's just go with it. This, a big weekend coming up for UW, which travels to face Utah on Thursday and Colorado on Saturday. If you look at the KenPom.com projections for the Pac-12 right now, UW, Colorado, and Utah all projected to finish 9-9 in conference play, along with two other teams. It would be a five-way tie for the fifth in the
Pac-12 basketball.
One of those teams, though, is going to emerge as kind of the cream of that crop, and I think that team does, in fact, have a good shot at making the NCAA tournament and being the fifth team in from the Pac-12, in addition to kind of the four top teams in the conference. So if you can steal a win in one of these road games in two very difficult places to play at altitude this weekend, that would go a long way toward helping the Huskies' chances of being that team. Utah has lost four in a row since sweeping the Oregon schools on the road to start conference play. All those difficult games, home for Arizona and Arizona State, and then they were at UCLA and USC last weekend. Their front court, I would say, is somewhat similar to Stanford's, which gave the Huskies zone some trouble, particularly on the offensive glass. They've got a pair of experienced, efficient big men, seniors David Collette and Tyler Rawson, both of whom are shooting precisely 60.4% from the field. An amazing coincidence. The other player to watch for Utah is their 5'8" grad transfer point guard, Justin Bibbins, who is shooting 47% from three-point range this year. Utah is a team ranks 36th in the nation in three-point attempt rate, so that's going to be big, cutting off the three-point line in that 2-3 zone on Thursday. Saturday...
What should we expect for Utah, though? What things will work for UW?
Against Utah?
Yeah.
I mean, they haven't been very good defensively this season. It's a team that's typically very efficient offensively under Larry Krystkowiak. That's kind of been their trademark. I think they shot like 75% against UW last year in Seattle, if I recall correctly. That's an
most teams do.
Figure. They particularly did. But despite the fact that they have some size and experience in the front court, still a team I think that you can score against, which, you know, the Huskies offense has been struggling the last few weeks here. Kind of ever since the halftime of that UCLA game, the offense has really not been the same for UW, which is now dropped to 141st in adjusted offensive efficiency.
And what are percentage chances of victory in this game?
KenPom gives the Huskies a 28% chance of winning this one.
And you feel like that's about right?
I mean, I have no reason to disagree with that.
Our percentage chance of victory for Husky basketball is reading KenPom.
It is. Colorado rated a little weaker than Utah, but they come in on a hot streak after getting swept in that road trip to the Oregon schools. They have subsequently won three of their last four games. They beat both Arizona and Arizona State in close games at home, and then got a 9-point win at UCLA, which was pretty impressive last weekend, although they did lose to USC. They turn the ball over really frequently, and they rarely force any turnovers. So the Huskies should have a big advantage in terms of the number of shots at the basket in this game, but they're pretty good at defending the shot. Their freshman 7-footer Dallas Walton has stepped up to play a bigger role in conference play, and he's helping protect the rim. On offense, the guy to stop is senior stretch four George King, who's a 39% three-point shooter and an excellent rebounder at just 6'6". So, you know, the kind of player that I think really gave the Huskies trouble in the past when they didn't have that ability to go match up with stretch fours. Now in the zone, maybe not as big of an issue for them.
They can match up a little better with him.
Yeah.
Especially with Dickerson, somebody who doesn't leave the paint very much. And what does KenPom have the percentage chances of that one?
35%. So that's the better chance of getting stealing a win on the road this weekend.
What are the chances overall of winning a game?
I mean, I feel like it's a little bit less than 50-50 the Huskies win a game. I mean, I think mathematically it plays out to almost exactly about there. So,
but the impact of winning a game would be huge for the rest of the season going forward.
Absolutely. And I think it would also, again, help build some momentum. Because one of the cool things about Saturday's game and the disappointment about how poorly the Huskies played is it seemed like the crowd was back for kind of the first time all year, other than the Gonzaga game. The turnout in the dog pack was terrific on Thursday against Cal, but 8 p.m. start on a Thursday, there was not a lot of other fans in the building. It was basically just the dog pack. the Stanford game seemed to draw out the casual fan a little bit more. And particularly with the Basketball Apple Cup coming up in a couple weeks here, it would be nice to see the Huskies give the fans a reason to come out.
Is that the next game after this road trip?
Yes.
Oh, they need to win a game.
Yeah, it'll be a three-game homestand for the Huskies after this. And it's interesting, once they complete this weekend, they'll have played five already of their nine conference road games and have still seven home games left with four road games out of their last 11. So
you think there's a chance if a team gets to 10-8 of sneaking into the NCAA tournament?
I think so. I mean, that would put the Huskies at 20 wins if they go 10-8 in conference. I think if you won the first round of the Pac-12 tournament, avoided an upset there, you would probably be in.
So they'd have to go, what are they, 3-2 right now?
They are 3-2, yes. Are you doing the math here? Oh, no. That's going to go poorly.
They'd have to go 7-6 for their next,
yes.
So the rest of the season.
Yes.
That's not impossible, right?
It's doable. It's not going to be easy because, again, the Huskies are not actually that good a team. But it's in the realm of possibility.
What is their RPI right now? RPI, we keep hearing these KenPom ratings, so we think the team is terrible. But then their RPI was actually pretty good.
But this is what's predictive of going forward. But yes, the RPI is meaningful in terms of what the selection committee will actually look at after the loss to Stanford.
We don't care if the team's actually good.
Huskies down to 50 in RPI.
Ugh, that loss was so bad to Stanford.
Colorado at 49. So there you go. There you go. Also in UW basketball news, you guys see that Nate Robinson has signed with the Big Three.
Oh, I didn't see that.
He is going to play for Tri-State alongside co-captain Jermaine O'Neal. And if there's ever a player whose game was perfect for the Big Three, it's Nate Robinson.
Yes.
Good for him.
So they haven't announced the 2018 schedule yet, just that the games this year are going to be on Friday nights and televised live on either Fox or FS1, as opposed to last year, they were tape delayed.
It's terrible.
So we'll see if Seattle is again one of the stops on the Big Three schedule. I'm hoping so, especially with Nate Robinson's drawing power to sell tickets.
What do you think Ice Cube's negotiation was like? I assume
Ice Cube is personally in the negotiation.
Just every single bit of minutia Ice Cube is handling.
Let me see this contract. I mean, I think also the salaries are pretty standardized. It's like
no, not with small. Nate Robinson, with getting the games televised live.
Yes,
like Ice Cube's in there, just being like, "What in the hell were we doing with these tape delayed games?"
Can I tell you a story, Hard?
Yes.
The Big Three.
I want to hear any Ice Cube stories just instantly.
No, it's not an Ice Cube story necessarily. The Big Three last season, their biggest financial windfall. They had T-Mobile Arena booked for their finale, which was played the same day as the McGregor fight, the McGregor Mayweather fight.
Okay.
So they were able, they got to negotiate to sell the arena to the fight. Think about that negotiation, what it looked like. And they ended up playing, I think, in the MGM Grand, their game earlier in the day, which was a perfect size for them, and got the financial windfall of getting bought out of that contract.
Good for them.
Not exactly great for their business going forward, but.
Hey, you know.
Now that they have Nate Robinson, everything's going to turn around.
A lot of the key for upstart leagues is just staying afloat at the start, and that's one way to do it.
I know that they don't play enough games, but could a player hypothetically go from high school to the Big Three, then to the NBA?
I don't think that's allowed under the rules. I think there's an... I don't know if there's an age minimum, but I think there's something in there that would...
Don't you feel like a league that was just picking up players who would have gone straight to the NBA could do well?
No, I don't think there's that much draw to those guys. Unless it's like the biggest of stars.
Yeah, that's what it would be. Like, let's say it was all the biggest stars did this.
I don't know. It's hard for me to see. I mean, you could make a lot more money playing overseas if you're that kind of player.
All right.
If you're Brandon Jones.
All right, fine.
UW women's basketball remains winless in Pac-12 play. Pretty impressive performance last Friday at Cal, losing 69-60 and keeping that one close. Then lost 71-45 at Stanford on Sunday. This week is the Women's Basketball Apple Cup. The way that works in the Pac-12 women's basketball is their schedule is 1 week shorter. You play both those games the same week. So the Huskies will be in Pullman on Wednesday night, and those two teams will play at Heckhead on Sunday afternoon. Cougs are 1-5 in conference play. So a rough go for the women's basketball teams in the state of Washington this year. Husky football. Big news that Miles Gaskin will return for his senior season, has bypassed the NFL draft. He needs just 52 yards to become UW's all-time leading rusher, having already set the school records for both rushing and total touchdowns. Told reporters that he received a fourth-round grade from the NFL Draft Advisory Board and decided based on that that he wanted to kind of finish what he started and felt that there was unfinished business after last year's Fiesta Bowl loss. And also mentioned that he didn't want to leave Jake Browning after starting together for 3 years. The idea of having those two guys as your starting backfield for 4 years is pretty incredible in any college football era.
Yes, it's exciting. I'm a little bit scared, though, about the other news that came out this week.
Both of these. So Bryce Love also announced that he's going to be returning to Stanford for a senior season. What are these people doing?
I'm worried for them.
Yeah, for their standpoint, we know what short lifespans running backs have in the NFL. I mean, I guess maybe the logic is that this year's running back class is loaded and you might be able to play yourself into a slightly higher spot any year. But if I were a running back, I would get to the NFL as soon as I could.
I mean, Bryce Love, I don't think, would have gotten a fourth round grade.
No. I mean, Love is in a different position than Myles Gaskin for sure.
What in the hell? it's fine. Everything's fine.
I mean, the consensus seems to be still that the Huskies are the Pac-12 favorite based on what else happened in terms of the quarterbacks, Sam Darnold and Josh Rosen, going to the NFL. I mean, they do host Stanford next year, so that gives them an edge if those two teams end up the top two teams in the conference.
I mean, I'm excited that Miles is coming back. I still want to see more Savon Ahmed be involved in the offense. I don't think Miles necessarily negates that, but it's exciting to see him come back. I'm just concerned for him as a person.
I mean, he does have the chance to go down as far and away the best running back in UW history. So there's something to be said for that. I agree with you that I think in terms of considering his long-term future, I would like to see UW not overuse him next year, especially without LaVon Coleman as kind of that 1B option. So, you know, whether that's a lot more Ahmed or Sean McGrew stepping into someone's larger role or, you know, even someone lower on the depth chart, you got to have someone else to kind of be that 1B, I think.
I think we have Kamari Pleasant, too, to kind of
fill
that role.
Yep, he would be another name, too. Elsewhere in UW football news, Jimmy Lake has been elevated to co-defensive coordinator and will handle play calling duties this year, taking them over from Pete Kwiatkowski, the incumbent defensive coordinator. Somewhat unsurprising to the extent that there seemed to be a lot of interest in Lake, who has been the defensive backs coach and has developed a tremendous number of NFL-caliber defensive backs, in him becoming a defensive coordinator. But also surprising to the extent that, like, it's not like things were going badly under Coach K and that he needed to give up play calling duties. That's kind of surprising to me.
My understanding is that maybe, you know, they needed to do this to keep him on board.
Right.
And that maybe this could be a way to kind of groom him to either take over the position in full in a couple years or maybe even move up higher, perhaps way down the road.
I mean, maybe not even way down the road. You have the kind of success the UW defense has. It's going to get attention. Yeah. I mean, I think, yeah, the surprising part is not that Jimmy Lake was trusted with this responsibility, because I think he would have been defensive coordinator and a play caller elsewhere. The surprising part is that Coach K had the lack of ego to be completely willing to cede that responsibility.
From what I've heard, they're like really good friends, and Coach K is just a nice guy, and this is not like out of character for him to do, but it's a... you know, big move for him to do that. So.
Exactly. It deserves certainly a lot of credit for him to do this. Other UW comings and goings, KJ Carter-Samuels, who had already announced that he would be leaving as a grad transfer after this year, is apparently headed to UCLA, where he will play for Chip Kelly and compete with incumbent backup Devin Modster and possibly four-star incoming recruit Dorian Thompson-Robinson, who is committed but not yet signed, for the starting job for UCLA, replacing the aforementioned Josh Rosen. This was a little bit of a surprise to me, because you would have thought that he was going to go to some place where he had a clear shot at a starting job.
But it still terrifies me.
the prospect of him in Chip Kelly's office?
Yes. I'm just scared of Chip Kelly. And
just like, as one should be.
The most Chip Kelly quarterback, KJ Carter-Samuels.
You think so?
No, very strange fit.
Run a little
bit. I don't think he's an un-Chip Kelly quarterback. The Huskies play at the Rose Bowl next season, so there is a very distinct possibility of Jake Browning versus KJ Carter-Samuels.
That would be something.
That would be something. Also transferring from UW, wide receiver Braden Dickey, who was formerly known as Braden Linnaeus before he legally changed his name in December, has announced that he will transfer, no destination yet. He was UW's biggest wide receiver target at 6'5", but despite that fact and despite the injuries they had at that position, had just 9 catches last season, none of them after week 5, so not a surprise.
Kind of a disappointing season
for sure.
The now Braden Dickey.
Yeah, so hopefully he'll find a chance to get more playing time elsewhere.
Is Troy Williams graduating from Utah?
I would think so, but I'm not sure about that.
It'd be kind of amazing if there were 3 Huskies or former Huskies starting across the Pac-12. Oh, wow.
Yeah, that would be a lot, yes. Yeah, he is. He graduated last year.
And still no official news about Jacob Eason. He announced that he's transferring from Georgia, but no news on exactly where he's going yet.
That is correct. We have not heard that he is not coming to UW, but not heard that he is. While we're on the topic of quarterbacks in the Pac-12, some really tragic news that goes beyond football coming out Tuesday is Washington State quarterback Tyler Helinski, who started the Holiday Bowl for them, was found dead of an apparent suicide. And I thought a very poignant post from Stephanie Lowe, who covers the Cougs for the Seattle Times, kind of reflecting on this, after the terrible news came out, saying, "I too am in shock. Helinski was always gregarious, cheerful, and respectful to both the media and his teammates, but you never know the personal demons each human being is fighting, so be kind to each other, everyone." And, it's interesting. After this news kind of first started to trickle out, I went to go search for Tyler Helinski on Twitter, and one of the first tweets you see is, someone complaining about his play. Mm-hmm. And obviously you don't know that something like this is going to happen, and there was never any intent, but it's probably an opportunity, I think, for all of us to reflect on, kind of how we talk about players, remembering that these are real people going through struggles in their lives that, we don't necessarily see on the football field or on the basketball court or wherever. And, that especially with young athletes to kind of, sometimes criticism is part of the, an analysis is part of the job, but still to keep it respectful and generally positive. So. Also, another passing in the past week, the legendary college football broadcaster Keith Jackson, who I think all of us kind of thought of is the voice of college football growing up, passed away at the age of 89. He's someone who, watching the Huskies as a kid, it was a sign that it was a big game when Keith Jackson was on the call, particularly in the Rose Bowl. And, I said this on Twitter, to me, the Rose Bowl is always going to sound like Keith Jackson. And I have this one very specific memory of as a kid, looking out the window and seeing it was already dark in Seattle at this point, going the end of the third quarter, going into the fourth quarter at the Rose Bowl, but it was still a little light in Pasadena because of the fact that the days are longer there in the winter. And then Keith Jackson on the call, that to me is always going to be my ideal of the Rose Bowl and also where the Huskies should be playing their bowl games. RIP to Keith Jackson, and our thoughts with his family as well. All right, should we talk about the Seahawks and more news on the coaching front as they have filled the vacancies that they created for themselves last week?
we've seen the whole cycle in a week, the life cycle of a coaching staff. So a week ago, I think today, while we were recording our podcast, Daryl Bevel was fired. Then shortly thereafter, the news about Tom Cable came out. Chris Richard was still kind of a strange one. And then we found out that Michael Barrow was also let go of the linebackers coach. We don't have a replacement for yet. But many people on Twitter have asked Bob Condotta about Lofa Tatupu.
Yeah, still not part of the staff.
Have you seen how, man, Bob Condotta's like you after eating that pepper. He is fiery now.
I think quite the opposite. I think he's much too gentle with people on Twitter.
Oh, he's not anymore. Bob Condotta's getting real.
Do you want to get off your Brian Schottenheimer takes?
I want you to get off your Brian Schottenheimer takes first because I want to respond to your Brian Schottenheimer takes because I know what they're going to be.
Okay. So I don't know if I want to preface this. But last week on the podcast, I had this to say. You could take the same career and you could make a case for him as a great offensive coordinator and a bad offensive coordinator, depending on what you chose to highlight. And then I noted on Twitter when the first Brian Schottenheimer rumor came out that maybe it was going to get a little more difficult. But you know what I say? Challenge accepted. Bring it on. There's something you need to know about new Seahawks offensive coordinator Brian Schottenheimer. He is one of the great turnaround artists in NFL history. You've heard all about where Schottenheimer's offense is ranked in DVOA by now, but there's an important piece of information missing, and that's where they ranked the year before he got there. When Schottenheimer first became an offensive coordinator, he took over a Jets offense that had ranked 31st in DVOA the season before, or second to last in the NFL. Under Schottenheimer's tutelage, New York climbed all the way to 12th in the NFL, a 19-place jump. 6 years later, Schottenheimer got the only more difficult assignment possible, taking over the worst offense in the NFL. The St. Louis Rams had ranked 32nd in last the year before hiring Schottenheimer. And while he wasn't quite able to engineer the historic turnaround he had in the Meadowlands, Schottenheimer improved the Rams to 21st, an 11-spot jump. Between his two jobs, that's an average of 15 places of improvement in the DVOA rankings. Given the Seahawks ranked 14th last year, if Schottenheimer can do the same thing in Seattle, the Seahawks would somehow rank, carry the five, minus first in the NFL in offensive DVOA. I will take it.
The worst. This is the worst take you've ever had. Is there more to it? Oh, God.
No, funny thing happened when these same teams forgot how much better Schottenheimer had made their offenses. As soon as they fired him, they got worse. The Jets dropped from 21st in 2011, Schottenheimer's last year in charge, to 30th the following season, almost as bad as they were before. And the Rams went from 25th back down to 29th. So what we have here is an offensive coordinator who makes his teams much better when he arrives and sees them become worse when he leaves. What on earth else would you be looking for in an offensive coordinator?
Somebody who is good in the interim, the years that they were coaching after their first year. Brian Schottenheimer has never been a good offensive coordinator.
No, he's never offensive coordinated a good team. Those are two totally different things.
Brian Schottenheimer has had offenses rated in the top half of the league in offensive DVOA twice in his 9-year career.
How many of those teams had talent that was top half talent?
Oh, I thought DVOA adjusted for defenses.
I don't understand. I mean, it doesn't adjust for the fact that you're starting Mark Sanchez.
Okay, twice.
There's not a Mark Sanchez adjusted offensive DVOA. That's not a thing that exists. I like the idea, though.
The butt fumble.
Guess what? The butt fumble.
He was also supposed to be a very good quarterback coach, too. And Mark Sanchez was a top five pick. Look, Mark Sanchez's career could have gone very differently without Brian Schottenheimer. Anyway.
No, it could not have.
Why do you say that?
Because his statistics coming out of USC indicated that he was a terrible top five pick.
Okay, Brian Schottenheimer.
Pete Carroll was absolutely right when Pete Carroll told Mark Sanchez to stay in school another year. And Mark Sanchez defied him to go to the NFL in an enormous mistake that doomed his entire career. Which, by the way, the butt fumble happened the year after Schottenheimer was there.
Wow. 50% of the years after he's an offensive coordinator, his quarterback butt fumbles. Anyway, he is ranked in the top half of the league two times as an offensive coordinator in his 9-year career, and one of those was 16th. He has not cracked the top 10 as an offensive coordinator in offensive DVOA. His best season as an offensive coordinator would have been Daryl Bevel's 6th best season. He is not a coordinator who has ever looked over a good team. And basically any coordinator at any random time finds a good offense at some point when they've been a coach for as long as he have. When he went to Georgia in college, Georgia ranked 49th in offensive efficiency. Grayson Lambert had a QBR of 1.8 against Alabama. This is the coordinator that you're defending.
Look, I will grant that he is not a good offensive coordinator in the college game, which is why I'm glad that UW didn't hire him. He has a long track record as an NFL offensive coordinator.
And he has been bad all of those years. He has a long track record of being bad. You're taking it, turning him around. Most offensive coordinators are better. I don't have any stats to back this up. It would be very complicated to do. But most offensive coordinators probably rank better in DVOA than they did before, making regression in the mean work for them. Most times they're replacing somebody who was fired who would have been really bad.
Well, I don't think he would have. Again, you keep saying this interchangeable. He was really bad. Versus the team was really
okay.
Bad. Offensive coordinators cannot be determined just by the success of the team. Otherwise, by the way, Daryl Bevel is the best offensive coordinator of the NFL in 2015. Did you think that?
Yes.
I'm a pretty big Daryl Bevel apologist. I did not think that he was the best offensive coordinator of the NFL. Again, the success or failure of a team is determined much more by its personnel than by its coaching.
So
that is indisputable.
I looked that up. I wanted to dispute your Brian Schottenheimer's good argument. Which is a bad argument. Because Brian Schottenheimer is not good. Brian Schottenheimer is fine. But then I looked back
at... But that's not your take. Your take was not that he's fine.
I looked back at Daryl Bevel, into his Vikings days, and I'm like, oh no, in his last year in Minnesota, they rated 27th in offense.
Well, there we go.
31st, 16th, 25th, 8th, and 27th. When, if you want to look at back-to-back years, Daryl Bevel to Brian Schottenheimer, this wasn't Mark Sanchez. They both had Brett Favre in consecutive seasons. Head-to-head, both teams, Brett Favre. With Minnesota, Daryl Bevel is the offensive coordinator, the offense ranked 8th. In New York, they ranked 18th, 21st in passing with Brett Favre as the quarterback. What is the difference between these two Brett Favres? He was younger in New York.
He didn't send any nude pictures when he was in Minnesota?
Brian Schottenheimer did not set Brett Favre up for success with the Jets. But
I just don't think you can say that just by looking at the statistics.
Which, this is all you do! Are you kidding me?
What I do is offensive coordinators are all the same.
No, this is your entire job is to explain things with statistics.
Yeah, but to explain things with statistics.
I understand now. You were telling me about how you judge pedigree for all stars in the NBA, and you're judging Brian Schottenheimer's pedigree based upon Marty Ball. Literally pedigree.
I judge players based on statistics that have a large enough sample size to be meaningful and that remain consistent from year to year. None of these things apply to offensive coordinators or any coach.
You don't think it would be nice to have a coordinator who has been good ever? Ever!
I mean, if he had one season where he'd been 12th with, or, you know, 10th.
He did. He had one season where he was 12th.
Which, by the way, I will undercut my own argument. 2 years before the previous season that Chad Pennington was healthy because he was injured. They ranked 4th in offensive DVOA in 2004. I mean, I'm not saying this was actually a good argument. What I'm saying is that you can make a case for any offensive coordinator.
You didn't really make that good of a case. But here's the case.
I do think is probably the best way to judge coordinators is what happens when they come and when they go. That which is what we've talked about doing for Daryl Bevel. I mean, granting that we're going to factor in some regression to the mean, we talked about judging the Seahawks based on how the offense does next year.
But here's a case that I can make, which is for offensive coordinators, you're either this average offensive coordinator like Daryl Bevel or Brian Schottenheimer, or you're a head coach. Those are the two elements. I was trying to think, who's a good offensive coordinator? And I was like, Kyle Shanahan is a good offensive coordinator, right?
Did you look up his 25th season?
Kyle Shanahan. He's had some okay years, but Kyle Shanahan, his last year as an offensive coordinator, ranked number one, which is the other thing. The year that you become a head coach, have a good offense, you better become a head coach because you're going to regress after that.
Which I really thought Daryl Bevel was going to become a head coach in 2015.
Daryl Bevel's biggest mistake was not becoming a head coach in 2016.
I mean, I don't think he was turning opportunities down. I don't think anyone.
Maybe he's a bad interviewer. Okay, but Kyle Shanahan ranks first, 23rd. I love that Sark is being raked over the coals for the Falcons' offense being a top 10 offense. But Kyle Shanahan's first season with the Falcons, they were 23rd.
It's weird. I was thinking about this earlier. I don't understand why I'm so defensive of Sark. I didn't even like him that much when he was UW's coach.
I love Sark.
Perfectly okay when he left.
If he would have been the Seahawks offensive coordinator, I would have been fired up.
It's just bad logic that is making me upset.
We just
here.
Can't quit Sark. Okay, first, 23rd, 24th, 23rd, 6th, 19th, 25th, 10th, 13th. So this good offensive coordinator had a top half of the league offense in less than half of his seasons as an offensive coordinator.
It's all random.
It's not all random. It's all dependent upon your players.
Sure.
You either have good players or you have bad players.
It's really what it boils down to. In Atlanta 2 years in a row. One year they were terrible.
I looked at Sean McVay too, and his first year in Washington, I think they were pretty bad. I didn't write it down because it didn't support my argument enough. But I think they're pretty bad, and he progressively made Washington better as an offensive coordinator. So maybe he's good, but he's a head coach. We can't hire fucking Sean McVay as the offensive coordinator. He's not out there.
Yeah, that would be a great hire, though.
Oh, God.
Sean McVay decides to leave the Rams head coaching job to be the Seahawks.
But even John DeFilippo, who we talked about and maybe would have won as the offensive coordinator, is being considered for right now potentially two different head coaching jobs. That's as a quarterback coach.
Yeah, which is crazy.
So you either turn your good season into a head coaching job, or eventually you're going to have a bunch of bad seasons. And I think Brian Schottenheimer, I'm not excited about the hire. There's really nothing to look at to say, oh, this is definitely going to make the Seahawks a much better team.
Except for him making teams better everywhere he went.
And he probably will make the team better.
Well, So what we said last week is that our expectation for the Seahawks offense, had Bevel return, was that they would have been about 10th in DVOA.
I think we said 8 to 10.
Yes. Where does Schottenheimer change that for you?
No.
Then what are we talking about here?
What do you mean?
Then why are you complaining about this then?
Do I think it would be worse? No, I just think it depends upon the players. Is Brian Schottenheimer going to be significantly worse? We could have gotten somebody who would be better though.
I don't know.
No, what I determined after really looking at all this is that offensive coordinators don't matter and we spend way too much time talking about fucking coordinators.
If only there had been someone making this argument beforehand who you could have listened to about this. Huh. If only.
The one coordinator who matters is Mike Solari.
I mean, that's the place where the Seahawks have the most room for improvement, certainly.
Because no matter what, the offensive line cannot be worse next year.
Another case where Solari has, as Bob Condotta has literally said, Solari has been in the NFL for so long that you can look at his track record and say whatever you want about his career.
Yes.
Like the fact that you can make the argument.
He has been the offensive line coach. By the offensive line coach, not the coach, not the quarterback, not the offensive coordinator, the offensive line coach is what we're trying to parse here. He has been the offensive line coach for some very good offensive lines.
But you can equally make the case that, oh, the Seahawks hired the offensive line coach from the Giants. That might have been one of the teams that had a worse offensive line than the Seahawks the last couple of years. So that's like, look, it's random. You can't get too worked up over it.
It's not random. It's dependent upon the personnel.
Fine.
But Tom Cable is the worst.
How do we feel about Chris Richard getting pushed aside in favor of Ken Morton, who is passed over for the defensive coordinator job in favor of Chris Richard?
Here's my issue with the Daryl Bevel firing and the Chris Richard firing, is that those two firings were not necessary. You didn't need to fire both coordinators to just fire Tom Cable. That's all you needed to do. There was one firing that needed to happen. There was one place that the Seahawks were very bad last season, and it was offensive line. Their offense in general was not terrible. It ran more or less like it should, but couldn't because of the offensive line. Their defense wasn't as good as they could have been because of injuries. And they went out and promptly got, or Ken Norton was the linebackers coach for the Seahawks, went and got a job for the Oakland Raiders, led a mediocre defense for his first season there, and promptly made them worse each following season before he was fired mid-season. There's nothing you can look at this Ken Norton hiring and say, this person is a better defensive coordinator than Chris Richard. He is a different defensive coordinator than Chris Richard. That's it.
I mean, the optimistic view is this. Pete Carroll knows both Chris Richard and Ken Norton extremely closely, has worked with both of them for a long period of time. And if he thought that Ken Norton was the better choice, then probably he had some reason to do that. Like perhaps Chris Richard
could
short of his expectation.
Couldn't he have hired Ken Norton as the defensive coordinator originally, though?
But at that point, Chris Richard's ability to actually be the defensive coordinator was an unknown. And the only conclusion we can draw here, I think, is that Chris Richard fell short of Pete Carroll's expectations as a defensive coordinator. Now, the pessimistic view, which has been espoused in many places, is that Pete Carroll basically wants to take more control of the defense, and Ken Norton is going to, you know, be more of the motivator type, and the X's and O's are going to be left more to Pete Carroll.
I'm actually okay with that.
I mean, I feel comfortable with Pete Carroll leading a defense.
Yeah. I mean, we have to trust in Pete Carroll. He's the head coach. We're getting so caught up in these coordinators, but Pete Carroll is the head coach here.
What does that mean, though, for the offensive side of the ball? If Pete Carroll is taking more control, is he only taking more control of the
defense?
He, runs
on 2nd and 10?
I mean, I think that means... The other aspect of it is kind of Pete Carroll wanting the Seahawks to get back to his vision of what good football is, and that features a lot of running. And maybe successful running, maybe positive yardage inside the 10. But one thing that Schottenheimer unquestionably has done well over the course of his career is coordinate rushing offenses. I mean, not unquestionably done well, but has been more successful than the passing offenses with the bad quarterbacks, litany of bad quarterbacks he's had. I mean, you know, he did certainly coordinate elite rushing offenses with the Jets. So I think the hope is to be able to do that here.
I'm just a little concerned. That kind of has parallels to me to Lorenzo Romar's last couple years, where he kind of doubled down and wanted to, you know, take more control of the team, and he wasn't letting his assistants coach, at least that was the rumor, and not really innovating when necessary.
And also Pete Carroll is 66 years old.
Yeah.
So the idea of him like being more involved on defense, like how much more involvement does Pete Carroll have at this stage of his career?
Pete Carroll has a lot more energy to give.
It's plant-based.
He could have given more to the team last year. Also, your elite rushing offenses, which Daryl Bevel led number one rushing attack and number three rushing attack during the peak Marshawn Lynch era. And number three under Thomas Rawls, too. People talk about how the Seahawks haven't been a good running team since Marshawn Lynch left. They were a really good running team after Marshawn Lynch left.
Well, he was still here. I don't know if you recall that season. He was still here.
After Marshawn Lynch.
He wasn't there at the Minnesota game, but he was still on the roster. He showed up at Carolina camp. I mean, I think the big
after Marshawn Lynch wasn't the primary running back.
I think the big difference between those teams is that the Seahawks had a quarterback who was involved in the rushing game, and Mark Sanchez was not that.
Ugh, just talking bad about the Sanchez.
I'm not a big Mark Sanchez guy. I'm going to be honest with you.
You're not a big Mark Sanchez guy.
I don't think it's going to work out for him as an NFL starting quarterback. That's my prediction. No, it's a hot take.
Brett Favre, you know, he just mix it up in the run game. Just playing backyard football.
Do we have anything else to say about the Seahawks coaching changes?
I don't even know. The only thing I have to say is that I really don't think that Bevel and Rashard needed to be fired.
I don't think so either. But
and I think that the offense probably, I think the offense and defense probably will be better next year. And I think they probably will be better under these new coordinators, but they would have been either way with Chris Rashard and Darrell Bevel. I think these are change for change sake.
That's definitely possible. The other Seahawks news of the past week is that cornerback Jeremy Lane was arrested early Monday morning on DUI charges. He tweeted afterwards that his blood alcohol limit was below the legal limit, and lo and behold, the arrest report indicated that his blood alcohol was measured at 0.039, about half of the legal limit of 0.08. But Lane admitted to smoking marijuana earlier in the evening, and there is also a state limit for THC concentration as part of the DUI law, so that may be where he gets in trouble here. And also, this is probably not that meaningful for the Seahawks because Jeremy Lane will almost certainly be released either way. So there you go. All right.
I'm still so mad at you for defending Brian Schott.
You knew I was going to do it.
I know. I thought you'd have a better argument.
I thought it was a really strong argument.
I didn't know what I thought you would come up with. If your argument was ignore most of the years that he was a coordinator.
No,
my only dwell on the first and the last year. Not even the last year. The first year and the year after he left.
Look at the bar. Look at the teams he was given and what happened with them. Because when you look just at the results, I mean, that's the best way of objectively measuring what is a fair expectation for a team going forward.
And Shoddy is...
I mean, first off, in LA in particular, it makes the case the problem here was not Brian Schottenheimer.
Yes.
The problem here was Jeff Fisher. And there were a lot of different offensive coordinators that they used under Jeff Fisher. And the Rams offense was terrible with all of them. So why you would choose to blame one specific of those individuals who had the most success of them is beyond me.
Well, Brian Schottenheimer, he will either be average, he'll basically continue what Darrell Bevel was doing and be this like right around 10th ranked offense, more or less like what you can do with Russell Wilson and not a lot else. Or he'll be a head coach somewhere.
Okay. So keep an eye out for that. That's your bold prediction.
Yes.
All right. On that note, thanks to the famous Cousin Katie for joining us and helping us with the double bracket. And thank you for listening.
Thanks.
Thanks for having me.